Today on Common Ground, creating South Africa.
One of the really dramatic things at the inauguration was after Mandela's speech, there was a flypast of planes, and the crowd of 170,000, of which I was part, went mad. And I found it very, very depressing, because to me it illustrated how deeply nationalism is colored with a militarist ideology. So even though these were fighter jets, even though these were, to my way of thinking, weapons of death and destruction that flew past in these tight military formations, the crowd loved it.
We'll begin a two-part look at the new South Africa on this edition of Common Ground. Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. The elections are over, the world media attention has turned elsewhere, and now the real work begins in South Africa.
No, I think that we have a very fair chance to succeed. One of the critical problems before the elections was whether we would be able to pull together the parties behind the outcome of the elections. And although it was there's a lot of tension, we have been able to do that reasonably well.
This is Patrick Terror Lakota, a longtime African National Congress official. He spent several years imprisoned with Nelson Mandela on Robben Island. Now he's the premier or governor of one of South Africa's nine provinces, the Orange Free State.
Secondly, one of the fears we had was that the white right wing would grow in strength, that therefore the numbers of whites who would be willing to subvert the negotiated settlement would be so big as to compel us to take suppressive action by way of trying to contain rebellion. But what has actually happened is that increasing numbers of whites have come behind the process of negotiations, including the larger section of what otherwise we have referred to as the far right wing. So we have the best possibilities, in fact I would say probabilities, of addressing the problems.
We're standing here in front of the ANC headquarters, and if you look across the street, you can see damage that was done, and then across the street in the next block from
yes.
Bombs that went off here. Are we going to see any more of this type of violence?
No, I don't think so. I think those were attempts to undermine the process, but they have all failed. If you look at the elections and the election days, they were absolutely peaceful. And as soon as some of the individuals who were doing this were arrested, only about 34 of them, it's petered out. So there's very little to fear. I'm sure that we will achieve a greater stability from now onwards.
Since the election, we've found out that the Reconstruction and Development Program may cost twice as much as the ANC was saying before the elections. Why is that, first of all? Why was there that discrepancy? And will the RDP still be implemented as the ANC wants it to be?
Well, the first thing is that the statistics have not been accurate. As the elections showed, there were several a couple of million people who were not anywhere featuring in the statistics. There were many elderly people who were not receiving pension, who were not recorded, therefore. And that's been one of the problems. The second problem, I think, has been that some of the decisions which were taken by the National Party regime just before the elections and so on were intended to compound the problem. But even in spite of that, I think that will be a problem that will be only for a short space of time. We should be able to bridge the gap within a reasonable amount of time, and I think we'll be able to implement the program of reconstruction and development.
The Reconstruction and Development Program, known as the RDP, is the government's massive blueprint for building houses, raising living standards, delivering education, health care, and everything else denied the black majority for so many years. The RDP has undergone near constant revision for months. Before the election, the ANC said the program would cost approximately $14 billion U.S. dollars over 5 years. Now, the estimates run as high as $33 billion U.S. dollars. Perhaps the only thing running higher than the cost of the RDP are the expectations of the people.
I think our main aim here is to make sure that development is even.
This is Norman Negwidzeni. He's the organizing secretary of the Soweto Civic Association. During apartheid, when blacks had little ability to organize politically, so-called civic associations like this one were perhaps the most effective grassroots representative bodies.
If you look at Johannesburg, the north part is affluent, and when you come more and more to the south, it's a poor area. So it's a very difficult task. And also there are other areas that are, you know, on the outskirts of Johannesburg that are squatter area and what have you. So we want to negotiate a deal that is going to be able to address the problem. In fact, to have a minimum standards of everything around this area. That is basic. Maybe, for example, that people should, or everybody should have access to water, because this area, it contributes in the gross domestic product. It contributes about maybe 40% of the whole of South Africa. So there's no point that everybody around this metropole cannot have access to water, to sewer, to at least either to housing, but we'll have to address that one as to how do we address that one. And also, you know, refuse and you know, decent roads and reasonable electricity, or everybody should gain access to electricity. Those are our aims, even if it's going to be very difficult to address all the inequalities around this area.
Negwidzeni is confident that the money will be found for the programs.
I think it's going to be a very difficult task, but what is going to happen is that, as you can see, the white area, I mean, they are to the standard of European countries, and those people were heavily subsidized by, I think the South African economy can be able to address some of the issues, but certainly we've got to tamper with the privileges as well, because people used to own a very big yards, and those people were subsidized, you know, even laying pipes, even those tents, you know, they got them very reasonable. And electricity, they were subsidized by the majority. So it must come to a point where we're saying every person must be subsidized equally. If every person is subsidized equally, it's not going to address also the inequality of services. And having said that, I think we must also say we have realized that you can't just take from the tax. That is why there is this reconstruction and development, where you will have to employ local people in building, you know, whatever, reconstructing, you know, building houses, laying pipes, sewer, and everything themselves, so that the money should circulate within here. You're creating a skill, and you're creating an employment, so that person must go and be employed there, and must be able to pay for services and also for housing. So people are no longer going to be subsidized heavily in northern suburbs. They'll have to to foot a certain portion, subsidy will be there. That is why they mean, hence the minimum standard should be there. As a result of that, like electricity, you know, electricity around this area, Johannesburg alone, was able to make some billions and also subsidize pavement and everything to Johannesburg. So once electricity makes, you know, profit, must also be redistributed equally to this other area. And sometimes in bias, I mean, it in favor of underdeveloped area. On the, but I think we need to be careful because that also can start another revolt, you know, in what area. So we've got to be very sensitive.
These are the sounds of a squatter camp in Soweto. Named after the martyred ANC hero, Chris Hani, this camp has more than 2,000 residents, all living in shanties and lean-to shacks made of scrap wood and corrugated metal. I spoke with the chairperson of the Chris Hani Civic Association, Patrick Madondo.
Do these kids that we see, do they go to school?
Sorry?
Do they go to school?
School? No.
Why not?
Before... Before we want a place whereby children are been accommodated, so that when that violence was started, everything was demolished. You know.
So now you just don't have a school.
We haven't got school here in our area.
You don't. No school.
Yeah.
Where do they, the materials? I mean, to build these, the tin. And the wood, where do they find that?
Which means maybe they find the old, like a second-hand material, you know, to build these shacks. Some of the residents are managed to buy the zinc to build their shacks, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting right here where we're standing. I mean, there are these shacks, but we can see over the hill what look to be some really nice houses.
As I say, most of our residents here are coming from the rural area, but even the government was not care about our people around this area. Mm. Yeah.
The old government or the new government?
The old government. Yeah. The old government.
Do you think things will be better now?
I think this... maybe things will be better now, no. Yeah, yeah. But we are still waiting and see what changes will be made. Yeah. Yeah.
Victor Velen is another resident of this settlement.
Most people say that expectations are so high that no government could ever satisfy them.
According to my point of view, I think we have to wait. Things will come step by step. We cannot expect everything to be with us within a moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But these people here don't have permanent homes, even. Do you think, how long will they wait for a home?
I think they can wait for about not more than 3 years, because even now, the campaign which is on, we are waiting to upgrade this place, putting pipes so that there must be sufficient water and toilets and so on. Then as soon as that is finished, there will be homes for us.
Workers are expecting to see the changes very soon. They've been promised that we are going to have so many houses, we are going to have your house electrified, you are going to have roads, etc. Now the workers, they want to see the affirmative action taking place in the factories. They wanted to see themselves climbing the ladder.
This is a trade unionist in the province of KwaZulu-Natal. Paul Ngobo is regional secretary for the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
Over and above that, the workers want to see their rights being exercised at the plant level. Because during the elections, when we were campaigning, we spoke about what the new government was going to do in terms of the workers' rights, how they were going to improve the workers' rights, and so on. in terms of the current situation now. Now, the workers would be expecting that to be implemented. So those are the things that we worried about, the question of the implementation of what we have been promising people, because the level of expectation at the moment is very high. Whenever you're campaigning for the elections, I was involved myself, you end up talking about something that you, when you begin to think about it yourself, how is this going to happen, this thing that I was talking about? But you have already promised the people. So I'm saying that people are beginning to talk about that. So I don't know how we're going to carry on. I must be honest with you. It is something that would need to be discussed within our own structures. The other day I was addressing the employers in this province. They wanted to know more about affirmative action, what it means for them. Because some of them, they are big bosses. They are saying to them that, listen, if your position was the one that deals with the workers' issues, for instance, if your position was that you were the human resources manager, that position now is going to be done by the black person, or it's going to be taken over by a black person, irrespective of whether the person does have the skills or not. Now, the employers themselves have got those fears that the workers would need to address, because it is clear that people are not fully aware of what the ANC was talking about when it was dealing with the question of affirmative action. Some of the workers are saying, we want to see the apartheid in reverse. I've also been approached by certain workers in this province saying that we're not happy about this. This is not enough. We've suffered for years and we want to pay the revenge. So it is something that needs to be seen. But we need to discuss it with our membership as to how best are we going to do this.
This is the first in a two-part Common Ground series on creating a new South Africa. Transcripts and cassette tapes of this broadcast are available. Listen at the end of the program for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that encourages discussion of international affairs. Besides meeting worker expectations, building homes, and raising living standards, the new government hopes the RDP will greatly improve the quality and quantity of education available to blacks. And there is much room for improvement.
Morning. These are our visitors from America. Say to them, how are you?
How are you?
This is the Morris Isaacson School in Soweto. The 1976 Soweto Uprising began at this school. It was the basis for the musical Serafina, and the film version was shot here. Now the grounds are covered with debris, the walls are crumbling, and many roofs have collapsed. Still, 1,100 students come here every school day. Judy Milongo is one of them.
I think there must be better houses, housing, better schooling, education, and they must provide us with scholarships.
I notice in the school, I mean, most of the windows are broken and the ceilings coming down. Why is that?
Oh, because some of the violences and some of our people here, some of them, they are illiterates. They don't want to go to school. They only just want to broke some of the schools. They don't want to attend. They don't want us to be educated.
Do you think that that'll change?
Yes, I think there will be a change, because when they repair some of the schools here, when you broke something, you're breaking Mandela.
Do you think that'll happen? That's what people will think?
I think so. It will happen.
Now, did you say, are you going to go to university?
Oh, I think so. I will.
And do what?
Pardon?
What will you do? What do you study at?
I want to do management.
We've been out to the Morris Isaacson School, where the walls are literally crumbling, falling down, and it's just amazing conditions. I know this may be hard for you to answer, but does a student who comes out of that, who completes his work there, his or her work there, have the ability to go to a university like this and succeed?
Yes, we have many. I'll give you I'll give you one example.
Dr. Ian Steadman is Dean of the Arts Faculty at the University of Witwatersrand, one of South Africa's most prestigious universities.
Jeremiah Mofokeng is a student who came out of the system, and he arrived at this university. At that time, he was one of a very few black students, but he had grabbed hold of the bottom rung of the ladder and hauled himself into the university system. And the moment he qualified in his four-year degree, he won a full Fulbright. And 3 years later, he had just finished his MA at Columbia University. And I was passing through New York, and I met him for lunch, and I said, "Jerry, how can I persuade you to come back and join the faculty?" And Jeremiah Mofokeng is one of our key teachers in the drama department at the moment. In fact, it's very hard to keep him there because he's being wooed by all sorts of professional theatre companies. That's one. His contemporary, Nchaveni Lerule, was the assistant director to Spike Lee on Malcolm X and on Jungle Fever, and he, one of our students, film student. He's just come back in the country. He's decided, now that we have a legitimate democratic government, he has just returned, and he says, "Right, now I'm prepared to work in this country," and he will also go far. And we have many other students. Many of them I have encouraged, especially the black students, I've encouraged to go and study, do postgraduate study abroad, because I think after the decades of apartheid, it was very important for them to go and get an experience in Germany, France, Britain, or America before they returned.
But when they come out of someplace like the Mork Isaacson School, yes, are they prepared for what they meet here?
Generally, no. There might be a couple of high flyers who, through extra work at school or through parents' influence or friends' influence, have got the credentials. But in most cases, those students would have to do the academic support program here.
A large standing army with nothing to do, I think, is potentially a very, very dangerous situation. It's an inflated, overblown army. It is going to absorb a lot of national resources. The present defense budget is something like 9.3 billion. And I have heard Jay Naidoo say, and I got him here to speak to my students, that people like him are hoping to finance much of the reconstruction and development program that the ANC is committed to as a way of providing jobs and houses for our people through cuts in defense spending, for example.
This is Jacqueline Cock, a professor and well-known author in South Africa. She just made reference to Jay Naidoo. He's the cabinet minister in charge of shepherding the RDP through parliament. The South African Defense Force, the SADF, is indeed growing larger. Members of the ANC armed wing, Mkhonto Sizwe, are guaranteed a place in the national force. In fact, the commander of Mkhonto Sizwe, Joe Madise, is now the Minister of Defense. The armies of the now-defunct Black Homelands will also be incorporated. During its years of isolation, South Africa developed its own heavy weapons production capability, a potentially high source of national income. The government, desperately in need of cash to fund the RDP, must consider some controversial tasks. Among them, cutting defense spending, demobilizing soldiers, and increasing arms exports.
But here you've got militarists saying, no, 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 we have to increase defense expenditure. I've heard many, not many, but I've heard people argue we need to increase it to 11 billion in order to maintain this large standing army, which I don't believe we need, which I see as inflated, overblown, and incredibly dangerous, because not only the way it'll absorb resources, but also it's going to block any demilitarization process. One of the really dramatic things at the inauguration was, after Mandela's speech, there was a flypast of planes, and the crowd of 170,000, of which I was part, went mad. And I found it very, very depressing, because to me it illustrated how deeply nationalism is colored with a militarist ideology. So even though these were fighter jets, even though these were, to my way of thinking, weapons of death and destruction that flew past in these tight military formations, the crowd loved it. And that says something. The alliance that has developed between military elites, between military people in the SADF and military people in the Homeland Armies and Umkhonto weSizwe. And I find this sinister because I think it is going to be very, very difficult now that these people have come to power and Joe Madisi is appointed Minister of Defence. It is going to be very difficult to unroll the process of militarization which we are a product of in South Africa. Now, by militarization, I'm talking about a long historical social process that involved mobilizing resources for war. And that happened at a political level in the 1976-1990 period, whereby the Security Council, which was dominated by military and police people, came to hold political power in the country. This process of militarization happened at an economic level through very high defense expenditure and the development of a powerful arms industry, which became the 10th largest arms industry in the world. It happened at the ideological level, at the level of ideas, through promoting what I've called an ideology of militarism, which accepted that violence was a legitimate solution to conflict. Now, the challenge facing us at this moment is to roll back this process. We've done it politically through our first democratic election, but the struggle now is to roll back this process at the economic level and at the level of ideas. What worries me is that these militarist elites from the different groupings have now come to power, and it is going to be very, very difficult to dislodge them. Joe Madisi is committed to building up a large defense force, and he is quoted as saying that the arms industry should triple its arms exports by the end of the century. We already supply arms to Rwanda. We supply G5s, it's a sort of long-range howitzer gun, to Iraq. The arms industry in South Africa is characterized by a total absence of morality, in that there'd be no restrictions on supplying arms to any regime, no matter how extensively it was involved in human rights abuses. And no one seems to be talking about transparency or accountability or restrictions on the arms industry. Now, on the contrary, you've now got a new defense minister who seems as committed to developing the arms industry as a source of jobs and foreign exchange and high technology as any of the Nationalist Party people were.
We'll continue our look at creating a new South Africa next week on Common Ground. We'll talk about the role of women, Afrikaners, the Inkatha Freedom Party, as well as the enormous human rights education program that has blanketed the country. Please join us. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9425, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9425. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.